Good evening and welcome to The Simple Truth. Every Saturday evening, 5 to 6 Pacific Standard Time and 8 to 9 Eastern on BBS Radio. Where if it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com. Tonight, Saturday, March 3rd, 2007. This will be our first and possibly last tape show. My producer has brought me up to speed here and only wants BBS Radio broadcasting live original programming. And I managed to get him to let me do this one show, though, on an amazing book that came out recently called The View from the Center of the Universe by Joel Premack and Nancy Ellen Abrams from NASA. The following audio portion of this DVD on the book will take you through a journey to the end of the known universe from a perspective not too many have ever entertained. This DVD is a presentation that was done at NASA October 2006. The visual portion of this DVD is a must-see, folks. This is definitely a book and DVD for your collection. Be sure to check in for updates at our main website at www.tobehealthynow.com. And for any questions, feel free to contact our host anytime at sacredtech@cox.net. And now, here's the show. So grab your healthy snacks and a bottle of good, pure, structured drinking water, and let's get started.
As everybody here knows, I'm sure, these are frightening times for our planet. We have global scale problems, but we don't seem to have any global scale way of solving them. One of the things we want to explain to you tonight is that the way that we look at the universe really can affect the way that we look at Earth and the way that we look at our responsibilities and the way that we solve our problems. We who are alive today have an extraordinary opportunity that's only arisen twice in the history of Western civilization, and that is the opportunity to see reality afresh through a new picture of the universe. The first time that the picture of the universe changed was when the understanding of the Earth as flat, which was the picture throughout all of ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt and Israel, was replaced by the Greek understanding that, in fact, the Earth is a sphere at the center of the universe and everything revolves around it. The second great transformation was when this ancient Greek and medieval picture was replaced by what we call today the Newtonian picture, and this happened, of course, through the Copernican Revolution, largely Copernicus, Galileo, and Newton. After this picture, now this is actually a painting by Escher, but it's very representative of the Newtonian picture, it's a kind of an endless grid. When this picture became generally accepted, people no longer saw Earth as the center of the universe, but just a planet that moved like all the other planets, and no place was special. I want to say that this picture is as wrong as the earlier one. And the real question is, what is the next transformation? What is the next picture of the universe? That's what we're here to describe tonight.
Scientific cosmology, the study of the origin, nature, and evolution of the entire universe, was until very recently the dataless fantasizing of theorists like me. But that has completely changed. Today we have what appears to be a reliable theory, which we're going to call the double dark theory, that has been tested against the entire visible universe. For the first time in human history, we may actually have the true story of the evolution of the universe. The challenge now, which Nancy and I try to meet in our book, The View from the Center of the Universe, is to present this new picture in a way that everybody can understand, because it's not the possession just of experts. It's the cosmic context of our lives and our planet, and it gives a large-scale meaning to what we're doing today.
Pre-scientific cosmologies were communicated with stories and images, like this one from ancient Egypt, which, if you look carefully, you'll see is the same flat Earth picture as in the biblical story, only here, all the parts, heaven, earth, and the space in between, are represented by gods that had their own stories. any cosmology that hopes to be generally accepted by the public, I feel, must also be able to be represented in stories and images. We are the same kind of people as those who lived 3,000 years ago. Genetically, we're identical, and we share many of their needs. If we want to feel like an integral part of the cosmos, we need to have a story and a picture of the universe that includes us. No scientific picture of the universe that posits it as being out there and we're somehow objective observers standing back here is ever going to feel satisfying. And worse than that, it's never going to be accurate because we're here. We're part of the universe. We need to be explained. Pre-scientific cosmologies place their believers at the center of the universe, however they imagine their universe. And although we've known since the time of Galileo that Earth is not the center of the universe geographically, what's turning out to be the case is that we, as intelligent creatures, are central or special in multiple unexpected ways that derive directly from the fundamental principles of physics and cosmology. So this is the gist of our talk. Cosmology is going through a scientific revolution that's creating humanity's first picture of the universe that might actually be true. In the scientific picture, it's turning out that we are cosmically central and we live at a pivotal time. We have the choice today to find meaning or not in our extraordinary place in the universe. But it's possible, for the first time since the rise of modern science, to see a meaningful universe that's not only consistent with science, but is actually suggested by it. And the goal of our book is both to show people how to think about this universe and also how to appreciate the fact that we are central in it. Simply opening to the possibility that being central may mean something can be transformative. Now, the notion that we're not central, that we are simply insignificant specks in a vast universe, is very deeply embedded in our culture. So Lucy said to Snoopy, "You are of no importance. Did you know that? You are only the tiniest speck in an enormous universe." And Snoopy sits for a minute and thinks, and then says, "Then I might as well go back to sleep." Okay, now here is the identical idea in Calvin and Hobbes. So Hobbes says, "What a clear night. Look at all the stars, millions of them." And Calvin says, "Yes, we're just tiny specks on a planet particle hurling through the infinite blackness." And they both look up at this immense sky of stars. And Calvin says, "Let's go in and turn on all the lights." But the fact is, the universe is nothing like this overwhelming, uncomfortable one that the cartoons assume. It's not a lot of randomly scattered stars. There are observable structures on many size scales, and in the context of all of them, we're not insignificant at all.
So my job is to take us on a little exploratory voyage through the modern picture of the universe. We're going to start close to home in the solar system, where we live on the third rock from the sun. It takes like 8 minutes to get from the sun to us, and a couple hours to cross the entire solar system. But it takes light about 25,000 years to get from the center of the galaxy out to where we are, and 100,000 years to cross the entire galaxy. Our galaxy is just one of these points. In the nearest 10,000 or so galaxies, which make up what we call the local superclusters, to get a sense of how these galaxies are organized, we're going to take a trip across the local supercluster from our own vicinity in the Milky Way to the center of the local supercluster, the Virgo cluster, which is the greatest concentration of galaxies within 100 million light years. Fasten your seatbelt. Now, does everybody recognize this constellation? This might help. So, Ryan, there's the belt. There's the sword. We're going to head for the sword. This video is made using the data from the Hipparchus satellite, which maps the distances to the nearest 100,000 or so stars. And we're using astronomical photographs, many of them with Hubble Space Telescope. This is the Orion Nebula, this big cloud of gas. lit up by the hot young stars that are forming in it. As we pass the Horsehead Nebula, we're now 1,500 light years from Earth. Here's another one of these stellar nurseries, the Rosette Nebula. Again, these bright young stars are lighting up a glowing gas cloud. But not all these glowing gas clouds are places where stars are born. This is a place where a star dies. We saw the supernova explosion on Earth about 1,000 years ago. This is the Crab Nebula. And you can see the Crab pulsar pulsing there in the center. The debris from explosions like this creates a tremendous amount of dust, which blocks our view in the disk of the Milky Way. So we're going to rise up and out of the disk so that we can see the gorgeous panorama of a gigantic galaxy like our own. As our galaxy recedes into the distance with the large and small Magellanic clouds and other satellite galaxies, everything we see now is a galaxy. Here's the other big galaxy in our local group, the Great Galaxy in Andromeda, and a smaller spiral galaxy, M33. As we pass through this glowing gas cloud in M33, we're now 2 million light years from home. Now we're heading for the Virgo cluster. But we're taking a scenic route past some of the prettiest nearby galaxies. Notice how the galaxies are not spread at random. There's a long filament of galaxies here. And we're going to ride down that filament as we approach the Virgo cluster. What we're in now is a group of galaxies called the Earth Major Cluster. They're all spiral. But as we get closer to the Virgo Cluster, we're seeing more elliptical galaxies, big balls of stars without a disk. The center of the Virgo Cluster is this gigantic elliptical galaxy, M87, which has a black hole at its center that weighs more than 2 billion times the mass of our sun, with this jet coming out of it. Well, that was a trip of about 60 million light years. But that was actually a very small trip compared to what we're going to do now. What we're going to do now is go as far as we can go with the deepest optical image that has yet been taken with the most advanced camera on Hubble Space Telescope. It's the ultra deep field, which was taken a couple of years ago by the Advanced Camera for Survey. In order to put this in perspective, we're going to start again looking toward the familiar constellation Orion. There's Orion. There's Taurus the Bull. We're going to focus in on a little spot down here. We start with astronomical photographs from the ground, switch over to photographs taken with one of the older cameras on space telescopes, and now switch to very deep images that were taken with the Advanced Camera for Survey. And now, the ultra-deep field, the deepest image that we've yet taken. Along with many other astronomers, I've been puzzling over what this could be, or this galaxy, or this oddly shaped thing, or this one, or that one. The very distant galaxies don't look like nearby galaxies. You don't see these regular spirals and elliptical galaxies. We can measure the distance to these galaxies and put them in the computer in three dimensions so that we can zoom into the picture. The galaxies that are disappearing off to the edge of the field are the nearby ones. All the light that we're looking at now has been traveling toward us for at least 4 billion years. Now about 8 billion years. now about 10 billion years. Do you see any more of those big spiral or elliptical galaxies? They apparently have not had time to form yet. We're now back to the first 2 billion years. Now the first billion years. If there were any more bright galaxies, Hubble Space Telescope would have seen them. Well, there's a different strategy that we can use to study the distribution of galaxies in the sky, and that's to map large regions of the sky. The biggest project, which is still ongoing, is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. A telescope at Apache Point, New Mexico, is being used to map all the galaxies that we can see from that telescope out to a distance of about 2 billion light years, all the reasonably bright galaxies, and the very bright galaxies out to a distance of 6 billion light years, and the quasars, which are brighter still, out to a distance of 28 billion light years. Now, some of you may be surprised, since the universe itself is less than 14 billion years old. We'll come back to that. But let's first of all look at how these galaxies are distributed in the sky. So what we're going to do is visualize the Data Release 4, which includes over 500,000 galaxies and over 75,000 quasars. Here they all are. This takes a little while. So we're backing away now from the nearby part of the universe. We're out about a billion light years. Now about 2 billion light years. As these red objects come in, they represent the very luminous or distant galaxies, which are mapped out to a distance of 6 billion light years. You can already see some of the structures. You see these walls of galaxies with voids in between. There's a lot of galaxies here, but that's just because that's a region that's been mapped in great detail, because we can see it very clearly from Apache Point, New Mexico. In order to get a three-dimensional sense of this distribution of galaxies, let's rotate the image. You can see how the distribution of galaxies is very frothy. The galaxies form these great walls with voids, with hardly any galaxies in between. Now the quasars. And now we're seeing the Big Bang from the outside. This is the heat radiation of the Big Bang itself.
Of a picture or symbol could possibly represent the theory, the understanding of the universe behind the cosmos that we've just seen. It's actually impossible to represent the entire universe with a single symbol. So what we're going to do is present a series of symbols. Each one represents the universe as a whole, but only from one angle. This represents the visible universe in time. Now, as you can see, we've taken that medieval picture of the heavenly spheres, and we've reinterpreted it completely. We call this the cosmic spheres of time, and our galaxy is at the center. These concentric circles don't represent space. What they represent is time. Each sphere, as you move outward, represents an earlier time in the history of the universe, with the earliest time, the Big Bang, being the outermost sphere. Telescopes see galaxies as they were when the light that's reaching us now left them billions of years ago. That's why looking out into space is the same as looking back in time. The light from farther away has taken much longer to get to us.
We are at the center of our past. Our past surrounds us. We're receiving light from the past all the time. From this sphere, we're receiving light that left those galaxies when the Sun and Earth were forming 4.5 billion years ago. The next sphere out represents the galaxies, the big galaxies that were just beginning to form about 10 billion years ago. And the sphere beyond that is, as far as we could see with the ultra-deep field, the first bright galaxies. Beyond that is the real dark ages, before the universe was lit up by the first bright galaxies. And beyond that is this very colorful sphere of the cosmic background radiation, as mapped by the latest instrument still mapping this data, the Microwave Anisotropy Probe, named after David Wilkinson. The slight differences in temperature in different directions in space are represented by these different colors, blue cooler, red hotter. They're only differences of a few millionths of a degree, but this very sensitive instrument can easily measure that. The outermost sphere is the Big Bang itself, or as we like to say, the cosmic horizon. We have a reliable theory that predicts a lot of the things that we can now see about the universe, and it allows us to calculate how far away all of these objects are today. We see them as they were when the light left them, but we can calculate where they actually are today. And we can calculate how far away the matter is that radiated that cosmic background radiation. The distance is 46 billion light years. How is that possible with the universe only 14 billion years old, 13.7 billion years old? What happened was that that light was radiated only about 400,000 years after the Big Bang, when that matter was only about 46 million light years away, closer than the Virgo cluster is today. But the universe was expanding very rapidly then, and that matter was moving away from us very rapidly. After that light was radiated and has been traveling toward us through the expanding universe ever since, the universe expanded by a huge factor, about a factor of 1,000. And that's how it is that that matter got to be 46 billion light years away now.
Fortunately, to discover your real place in the universe, you don't have to understand the underlying cosmological theories like a scientist, any more than you have to be a professional auto mechanic to drive your car. However, if you want to drive your car, there are certain things you have to learn. You have to learn the rules of the road, and you have to start getting some kind of an intuitive feel for driving. And in the same way, you can start to get an intuitive feel for the universe if you practice living consciously in the universe. And to get the benefits of being central, you have to start thinking of yourself as central. And we do this by representing ourselves at the center of any image that we use to represent the universe. Now, at the end of that last video, you saw the Big Bang from the outside. That's not the way we would really do better to look at it. We really need to look at it from the inside, where we are. And that's how we have it represented here. The cosmic spheres of time place us at the center, but it's still drawn as if they're up there on the screen and we're back here objectively looking at it. So what would really be best is, in your imagination, jump into the picture. Put yourself in that center and close those spheres around yourself. And when you do this, you're immersed in the history of the universe. You're immersed in the past. When we begin to do this, we begin to see what it might feel like to have a place in the universe. It's not the old-fashioned kind of time, light, and consciousness. Because without consciousness, there's no visible universe. The cosmic spheres of time are real, and we know that because evidence of them is arriving all the time. So let me just explain it with a kind of an image. In the ancient world, if people wanted to get a message to someone, they had to send a runner, and the runner took time. So there was no instant communication like email or telephone. You just had to wait. And in the universe, this is very much what's happening here. We are receiving messages that are coming to us from all over the universe from billions of years ago, carrying on radiation the news of ancient eras. And the cosmological revolution that's happening today really is people finally being able to decode all those messages, understand the news, and put the whole thing together into a coherent story.
The time at which we're living today is cosmologically special in several ways. My astronomy colleagues like to point out to the funding agencies that this is the optimal moment in the entire history of the universe for astronomical observation. After all, it took billions of years of cosmological evolution and evolution of life on Earth to produce creatures with the technological ability to see the distant galaxies, as you see them there. But because the expansion of the universe is accelerating, the most distant galaxies are starting to disappear over the cosmic horizon. There will never be, again, so many visible galaxies. So fund us quick. Second, we are living close to the midpoint of the life of the Sun and the Earth. This graph shows the increasing temperature of the Sun on this axis, and this is the time. The solar system started about 4.5 billion years ago, and in about another 5 or 6 billion years, the Sun is going to turn into a red giant star. It'll swallow up the inner planets and burn Earth to a crisp. We are also living in the middle of the best period of Earth. About 500 million years ago, the microscopic creatures on Earth produced an oxygen-rich atmosphere, and that allowed the evolution of the first large creatures, the Cambrian explosion, it's called in biology. We're living right in the middle of this best period. In another 500 million years, the increasing heat from the Sun, like all middle-age stars of its type, is growing hotter because of the accumulation of the nuclear ash, helium, in its center. The increasing heat is going to evaporate all the oceans, and the water will be dissociated at the top of the atmosphere, and the Earth will permanently lose hydrogen, and if there's any life left, it'll just be microbial. Well, actually, this could be averted by our distant descendants by moving Earth steadily farther away from the Sun, which could be done by altering the orbit of large comets. You can ask me about that later if you like. But we have a much more pressing problem. In the last few hundred years, the population of humans on the Earth has exploded. It's very unlikely that the Earth could support another doubling of the human population. Unfortunately, the population growth rate actually peaked about 35 years ago, and it's been coming down since then. But our use of technology has continued to grow exponentially. Americans, on average, use every day our weight in natural resources. It's unlikely that the entire planet could use resources at this rate without disaster. It's not even clear that we can continue to do so. One of the symptoms is the increasing amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. What this graph shows is both the history of carbon dioxide in green and the temperature plotted in red in the interglacial period and in blue during the ice ages. And what we see is that for the last 450,000 years, the amount of carbon dioxide has never exceeded 300 parts per million in the atmosphere. Actually, the ice core record now goes back another 150,000 years, and again, it never exceeded that. But now it's up nearly at 400 parts per million. And at the rate that we're going, it's going to be impossible to have the carbon dioxide level less than about 500 parts per million by the middle of this century. The fact that the temperature has been in lockstep with carbon dioxide, plus climate modeling of the sort that's done here at NASA Ames, for example, shows that it's going to be very difficult to avert very great changes in the Earth's climate as a result of this very sudden increase in the amount of carbon dioxide, which is certainly due to human activities on Earth. So here's just one example of the sorts of technological changes that we're causing. We're causing the extinction of species at a greater rate than since the episode 55 million years ago that ended the period of dinosaurs on the Earth. The conclusion is that our descendants could have at least hundreds of millions of years to live together if we can just get through the next few decades without disaster.
This is a pivotal time for the human species because as time goes on here, and time continues here, where is this curve going to go? It could come crashing down because of war or famine or some other kind of disaster. It could continue to go up and then crash. It could go all different ways, but it could also just gently turn and start to go down slowly. It's our choice right now. We are at this pivotal moment. Now, not only are we at the center of time in this sense and several others that Joel just mentioned, and we're at the center of our visible universe. But it turns out that we and our planet are made of the rarest material in the universe, stardust. You've seen that this is what the universe looks like to Hubble Space Telescope, and it's very beautiful, but it's completely misleading because all it shows is light, and light reveals less than half of 1% of what's out there. What's the rest? It's called dark matter and dark energy. One way to visualize this is it's as if the entire universe is filled with an ocean. And that ocean is made of dark energy, which is the energy that powers the expansion of the universe. On that ocean, there sail billions of ghost ships made of dark matter. At the top of the tallest masts of only the largest ships are little tiny beacons of light. And those beacons of light are what you see in this photograph. We don't see the ships. We don't see the ocean, but we know they're there through theory, specifically what we're calling the double dark theory for dark energy and dark matter. It has been an enormous challenge to figure out what the entire universe is made of, but it turned out to be absolutely essential because what it's made of determines how it works. This is a symbol that Joel and I are using to represent what the universe that we see is made of. And I'm sure you all recognize this picture. It's on the back of the dollar bill. It's also on the back of the Great Seal of the United States. We've borrowed it, of course. The ribbon at the bottom says in Latin, the new order of the ages, and that's what this new universe picture is going to become.
The way we're using this is we're using the bottom part, which of course represents the 13 colonies in the 13 layers of brick, to represent most of the material in the visible universe. Almost 99% of it, which is just hydrogen and helium. Hydrogen and helium are what come out of the Big Bang in a ratio by mass of about 3 to 1, 3 hydrogen to 1 helium. Hydrogen and helium form the first stars, and in those stars, nuclear processes made all the heavier elements, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, iron, and all the rest. At the end of the life of those stars, various processes, including supernovae, spew out those elements as stardust. They're then incorporated into subsequent generations of stars and then planetary systems. And, of course, that's how we got here. The eye, which in the seal of the United States represents the eye of providence, shining down, hopefully, on this new order of the ages, the 13 colonies. We're using it to represent all the intelligent life in the universe, which actually can see the visible universe. It's the only part that's not drawn to scale. The volume of the two parts of the pyramid actually represent accurately the amounts of the hydrogen, helium, and the heavy elements. The eye is way out of scale, but if we drew it to scale, it would just be a tiniest point on the top of the pyramid, since such a tiny amount of carbon and the other elements are actually involved in intelligent creatures. Well, this is what the visible universe is represented by. You'll notice that the pyramid is sitting on the ground. What's underneath? We invite you to imagine an enormous, invisible pyramid. What you saw is half of 1% of what's there. The other 99.5% is invisible. About 4% is atoms, but they're not lit up. They're not stars. They're not lighted by stars. They're out in between the galaxies. About 25% is a mysterious substance that's not made of atoms. It's not made of the parts of atoms. We call it cold dark matter. It's a term that I proposed back in 1983, which caught on. And the vast majority is actually something that's even more mysterious, and we call it dark energy. Why should anybody believe that 99.5% of the entire universe is some mysterious, invisible stuff? The answer is that the theory that's based on this made lots of predictions. And the predictions are all coming true. As the data comes in, it keeps looking just like the theory predicted. Here's one of the most dramatic examples. The prediction of the theory, the double dark theory, is represented by this blue curve. The predictions were worked out a long time ago. When the data came in from the latest mapper of the cosmic background radiation, it's those white dots. The white dots are all independent pieces of data. And the fact that they follow that curve is really quite amazing and shows that there must be something fundamentally right about this theory. What the theory is predicting and what the data represents is the sizes of these different dots and basically where the structure is. And what you see is that 1 degree is really a preferred scale of structure. Half a degree is disfavored, a third of a degree is favored, a quarter degree is disfavored. This is data from the ground. As more data has come in over the last 3 years, the agreement is getting better and better with the theory, which is the kind of thing that reassures us that we're really on the right track. Now what we're going to do is show you something about what the dark matter looks like.
This is a drunk guy sitting on the steps talking to his friend. He says, quarks, neutrinos, mesons, all those damn particles you can't see, that's what drove me to drink. But now I can see them. The reason we show you this is that now we too can see what's invisible because we have computer simulations. So you're going to be able to see the universe evolving. You're going to be able to watch the dark matter as the universe evolves. I just want to point out that in all of the earlier videos, what you saw was light that was captured by telescopes. But in this computer simulation, what looks like light, what looks like brightness, represents density. Everything in this video is invisible. It's just dark matter. So use your imagination. You're seeing the density of it. You're seeing where it is.
If we showed you the evolution of a little piece of the universe, we'd have to show it starting very small and growing in size. But if we did it like that, you wouldn't be able to see what's going on when it's small. So what we do instead is we blow it up so that each of these is the same size that it will eventually be. Also, in a moment when we show you the visualization, we're going to rotate the volume so that you can see the three-dimensional structure. Now, what you see is that it starts very smooth. The dark matter starts very smooth. But already 2 billion years after the Big Bang, there's a lot of structure, and it turns out that the dark matter is attracted to wrinkles in space that are laid down in the first fraction of a second of the Big Bang by a process called cosmic inflation. This is the simulation. It was run on the Columbia supercomputer just inside the gate here at NASA Ames. It's the world's fastest supercomputer for this kind of work. This is a clock counting down the billions of years since the Big Bang. And you can see already about 3 billion years, all this structure, these filaments of dark matter, and the galaxies are forming along the filaments of dark matter. As Nancy said, the yellow regions are not the galaxies, they're the dark matter, but they're the dense regions of dark matter within which galaxies are forming. The distribution of galaxies as predicted by this picture can be checked statistically against the observed distribution, the kind of distribution of galaxies that you saw plotted in that first video of the voyage to the Virgo cluster, and the agreement is spectacularly good. Let's look at the evolution of just the dark matter that hosts one galaxy the size of our own Milky Way. So here's this little region where the galaxy is forming, and you see there are a lot of clumps of dark matter that come together. They go through each other. Within each clump, there's a little galaxy forming. But these galaxies are being buffeted all the time as other chunks are coming together. And that's why we think those early galaxies look so ragged and don't look like the spiral galaxies and elliptical galaxies we see nearby. But as time goes on, you see that a typical large clump only has little small clumps falling in. And so it'll be surrounded by some satellite galaxies, but it itself can evolve into a nice smooth structure like the beautiful disk galaxy that we live in.
The way to begin to intuitively grasp the universe as a whole is to try to visualize in the mind's eye the invisible as well as the visible, since the invisible is most of it. We can now do this accurately because we have telescopes and supercomputers, we have conceptual tools like the double dark theory. But what lets us do it meaningfully is to put ourselves into the picture. So we've suggested two ways so far. The symbol of the cosmic spheres of time lets us visualize ourselves immersed in the past of the universe. The symbol of the cosmic density pyramid lets us visualize ourselves in relation to all the other ingredients in the universe. And now we're going to suggest a third way of visualizing the entire universe, but this time not from the point of view of time or ingredients, but from the point of view of size. What is the meaning of size? Why are things the size that they are? In the almost unimaginably wide range of sizes that are possible, it turns out that we human beings are almost exactly in the middle, and we couldn't be anywhere else, because only on that size scale could consciousness as complex as our own exist. This symbol we call the cosmic Ouroboros. And now an Ouroboros is a serpent that swallows its tail. The word is Greek, but the symbol is actually much older than ancient Greece. It's been used in many cultures independently. In pre-scientific cultures, the Ouroboros was used to represent some kind of a cosmic concept. The endless cycles of time, the completeness of the universe, it could be the horizon of the world. But it was always something cosmic, and we are using it the same way. We're using it for the concept that we want to represent, which is the vast range of possible sizes in our cosmos. We've arrayed the sizes logarithmically around the serpent, with the smallest size at the tip of the tail and the largest size at the head, the largest size being the visible universe. Now, each tick mark as you move along the cosmic Ouroboros is a change in size of 10 to the 5, which means that the object at that tick mark will be 100,000 times bigger than the object at the prior tick mark. There's a lot of different sizes in the universe. The first person to use the Ouroboros this way was the Nobel Prize winner in physics, Sheldon Glashow.
In our book, we make a lot of points about the cosmic Ouroboros, but I just want to make one point now, and that is that on different size scales, different forces are important. On all the big size scales, gravity is the important force. On our own size scale, the middle range of sizes, it's the electromagnetic forces which give rise to the chemical attractions and repulsions between atoms. On the scale of the nucleus, it's the weak and strong forces. Now, we've got a good theory of the weak, strong, and electromagnetic forces, and there's no room in that standard model of particle physics for any dark matter. But dark matter is most of the mass in the universe, so there must be something else that we haven't discovered yet on smaller size scales, we think. So we think the dark matter must be connected with that. On the very smallest size scale, the tip of the tail, the Planck scale, we hope Shelley Glashow hoped, that's why he represented things with this ancient symbol, that there's a connection between the forces on a very small scale and the gravitational force which dominates on large scales. And our best hope of a theory that goes beyond our current theories, which is called superstring theory, actually realizes this connection. The only problem is that superstring theory doesn't yet make any predictions that allow us to test it, except possibly the existence of supersymmetric particles. And many people think that the best possibility for what the dark matter is that it's a supersymmetric partner particle to our the particles that we know and love. That's a theory that Heinz Fagels and I proposed back in 1982, and we're hoping that we're going to be able to test that maybe next year when the Large Hadron Collider turns on in Geneva and gives us the chance to see interactions 10 times higher energy than we ever have before. We hope that that's going to be enough energy to make dark matter particles in the laboratory. That machine's going to turn on July 1st, 2007, and since it's being built in Switzerland, it probably will turn on July 1st, 2007. Now, different forces are important on different size scales, so size really matters. Galileo was the one who first appreciated this. Galileo drew these pictures of bones of these two different sizes, and his point was that if there's a creature that has bones that are three times longer, that play the same role, like a leg bone, the bones can't be the same shape. They have to be a lot thicker. Why? If the creature is three times longer in all dimensions, it weighs not three, not nine, but 27 times more, because it's bigger in all three dimensions. If its bones just scaled up the same way, they'd be nine times larger in cross-sections that have 9 times the strength. They couldn't hold up a creature that's 27 times larger. The mass of the creature would crush the bone. So a large creature like an elephant can't look anything like a smaller creature like a gazelle, just scaled up. Do you think Hollywood understands that?
Every size scale, as you move around the cosmic Ouroboros, is in seamless continuity with the one before, and yet, every few powers of 10, suddenly you get a completely new phenomenon. Temperature exists, or consciousness. More is different. Qualitative change occurring every few powers of 10 seems to be a universal pattern. What difference would it make in our lives if we took this seriously? Could it give us some kind of a new way of thinking about ourselves? Exponential growth doesn't just happen in the size of things. It also happens in the complexity of human interaction. If we took it seriously, we might start to see why human beings are very often kind and generous, but a committee is never kind and generous. A city is never kind and generous, or a country even. Why is that? A group of people cannot, in principle, act like a human being, even though it's made entirely of human beings. And this may seem strange, but if you think about it, every one of you is made of elementary particles, but you don't act anything like elementary particles. You're on a different size scale. The problem is that people are still thinking about global politics and economics with understandings and moral judgments and, above all, a sense of time that's really only applicable to smaller size scales, like a family, a community, a year, a human lifetime. They don't seem to have any way of comprehending the thousands and even millions of years that things people are doing to our planet today can last. Extinction, after all, is forever. The inevitability of qualitative change every few powers of 10 raises the question of what corresponding changes in ethics are required when modern leaders control events on enormous time and size scales that no political or religious tradition has ever even contemplated. In the emerging global culture, our tribe is now the human species, for better or for worse, and maybe also some other species, and our traditions can no more tell us what is right and wrong on this size scale than they can tell us what's scientifically correct. So if we want to act morally today, we have to have knowledge as to what the needs of our time are, that is, the needs of this pivotal time, which is unique in the history of our species. Now, we are at the center of the cosmic Ouroboros. What's the blue section? What does that mean? The blue section is the range of size scales that human beings have always been able to see and know something about. It ranges from the size of an insect smaller than an ant up to about the size of the sun. We have intuition about how things work on those size scales. In our book, we decided to give those size scales a name, and we call them Midgard. Midgard is a name that's borrowed from the Norse mythology of the Eddas. Midgard is what most people think of as reality. But as you can see, it's only a small part of reality. But it's a special part of reality. It's our homeland in the universe. Now, Midgard is everywhere in the universe. It's not a place. What it is a setting of the intellectual zoom lens. It has to do with our focus. If you were on a planet, for example, in a galaxy a billion light years away, and trying to get around, your Midgard intuition would be very useful, but fallible. But even if we just stay right in this room, and we start to think about size scales outside Midgard, our intuition about how things work becomes completely useless. Everything outside Midgard can only be known through science, and only experienced, if at all, spiritually. And we might use the word transcendent for these realms from the point of view of human beings. Transcendence can be a very useful concept, but not if we think of it as some kind of a magical jump to a realm outside the universe. That doesn't make any sense in modern science. transcendence happens many times in this universe every time we go across a substantial number of the powers of 10. For example, on the atomic scale, human means nothing. If your atoms are in you, in a rock, floating through space, it's all the same to them. So on the atomic scale, we don't exist. Even inside our own bodies, we don't exist. We are something that transcends atoms. And in the same way, the universe as a whole transcends the familiar Midgard.
We've given you three different ways of the many ways that are possible to think about the new universe, and in each way, we are communicating our centrality, or the special aspect of our part of the universe. We are the center of our cosmic spheres of time, just as any observer is. But now we know it's true. We are made of the rarest stuff in the universe, heavy elements. They represent 0.01%. That's rarer even than neutrinos. Pretty special. We are in the middle of all possible size scales, and that's the only place that intelligent creatures could be. They couldn't be much smaller, they wouldn't be complex enough. If they were much larger, the slow speed of communication would mean that they would not be a single organism, but maybe a community. What this teaches us is that we have to use many different metaphors to understand different aspects of the new universe. One shouldn't imagine that any one of these communicates the whole picture. You have to learn to juggle a number of different independent conceptions of the universe that are not mutually exclusive. This should inspire humility and help us realize that the universe is beyond any particular metaphor.
So, in conclusion, let's shift gears one more time and come back to the question of meaning that was raised by those Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes cartoons. Those cartoons assumed a kind of an existential view that we're just insignificant specks in a vast universe that doesn't care about us. This is actually the assumption of many scientifically literate people today. Joel and I started out of the existential camp ourselves, and here we are in our existential period. Joel wrote in 1984, "If the bulk of the matter in the universe is not made of atoms, that is yet another blow to anthropocentricity. Not only is man not the center of the universe physically, Copernicus, or biologically, Darwin, it now appears that we and all that we see are not even made of the predominant variety of matter in the universe." But when we started teaching our course at the University of California called Cosmology and Culture, we started teaching the cosmic Ouroboros, and we realized maybe it matters that humans are at the center of all possible sizes. And then we realized, well, maybe stardust should be seen as rare rather than insignificant. In fact, the whole facade, the whole existential facade of despair and stoicism flips inside out when we begin to see the universe from the inside, which is where we indisputably are. So once we made this mental shift to the view from the center of the universe, so to speak, we not only kept discovering more ways that were central, but we discovered that it evokes the opposite emotions from the existential stance. Not resignation, but hope, and not cynicism, but excitement. Romantics are made of stardust, but cynics are made of the nuclear waste of dead stars. This illustrates pretty well the contrast between the existential point of view and the point of view that we're trying to talk about tonight, which we might call the meaningful point. The attitude, which one of these we choose, is not arbitrary. It has real-world consequences. The atoms that come out of exploding stars are what introduce into matter the possibility of complexity. And the possibility of complexity is what has allowed the evolution of life, planets, and intelligence. If we call those atoms garbage, we're basically choosing to call ourselves garbage. And it leads to the kind of attitude that makes people resign themselves to a short, dark future and even mock efforts to save the planet. Or it leads them to think, oh, we're just insignificant specks. How important could the damage we're doing today be?
A new cosmology have the power to overturn the fundamental institutions of society. This is, in fact, what happened in the last cosmological revolution on the scale of the current one, when the Copernican-Newtonian cosmology replaced the medieval cosmology of the heavenly spheres. That revolution undercut the rigid social and religious hierarchies of medieval society that had been justified by their picture of the heavens. And soon, the divine right of king was challenged, and the king of England lost not only his throne, but his head. And soon the same thing happened to the king of France. This is the kind of practical consequences that can result from a change in cosmology. We need to learn how to see the long-range consequences of our choices. Cosmological concepts are metaphorical when applied to human life, but they can open our eyes to new ways of seeing.
In summary, a new scientific cosmology is emerging today, and in each of the icons above, most of which, unfortunately, we have not had time to explain to you, the point represents our central or special place in the cosmos. How will a new picture of the universe at the turn of the 21st century affect global culture? Can the new cosmos provide new metaphors and inspire us to approach global problems in new ways? For thousands of years, our ancestors drew much of their self-confidence from experiencing themselves at the center of the cosmos. But for the past few centuries, those of us who believe in science simply couldn't see ourselves that way. But now we can. Joel and I are not talking about a new religion. Please don't misunderstand us. All we're talking about is experiencing the potential significance of being intelligent life at the center of a universe that works like ours. In other words, we're talking about taking science and its logical implications seriously. Our time seems ordinary to us, but it's going to be mythic to the future of our planet because it is so pivotal. If we wake up to the reality of this universe, and if we expand our interpretation of our own tradition to encompass this new knowledge, then we can become ancestors worthy of tremendous honor. If we don't, then our short-sightedness and blame games may lead again, as they did in the story of Adam and Eve, to expulsion from the garden, which is Earth. Those of us who are not cosmologists can very easily think, oh, isn't this all interesting cosmology, very entertaining? But if we do that, we will never understand why, as Yeats wrote, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. If we begin to teach this new picture to our children and to each other and to integrate it into our thinking and into our art as if this is the real universe, we could have a new enlightenment. Because in the meaningful universe, the center does hold. We're at the center of a vast cosmic adventure. We're not outside it and we're not at its end. You're on the side of this mountain and you push a boulder. It'll just roll down a little bit. And that's that. But if you're at the peak of a mountain, then there are many ways you can push the boulder, and it really matters which way you choose. We are at the peak moment of our species, and we need a cosmic perspective to understand the consequences of pushing the boulder one way rather than another. And the amazing thing is, science is providing us with that perspective right now, not a moment too soon. Thank you very much.
Wow, that's the end of tonight's show. Be sure to see this DVD. The visuals are spectacular. I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Thanks for tuning in.